This is Anna Carmu with UN News. The longer we wait for the substantial reduction of emissions, the more carbon dioxide we need to remove from the atmosphere, said Jonas Pastor, Executive Director for the Carnegie Climate Geoengineering Governance Initiative, or C2G2, adding that if the world doesn't act fast, the process will be not only more challenging but also more expensive. Mr. Pastor highlighted the fact that the world reached a point where the reduction of emissions is no longer sufficient. Carbon dioxide removal was pointed by the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, as one of the actions the world leaders need to take to keep temperatures below 1.5 degrees Celsius. Yasmina Guerda sat down with Mr. Pastor at COP24 earlier this month to talk about the technology that can be used to help with this global problem and its challenges and risks.
The initiative is aiming to develop and to contribute to the development of effective governance frameworks for different geoengineering techniques, carbon dioxide removal or solar radiation modification. We're not promoting any of these technologies. That's not our business. That's for governments to decide. But what we're saying is if governments do decide to make use of these technologies, then we need to ensure that they're well governed. And that is our job. It's about access to information, yes, it's about enhancing participation of different stakeholders, but it's also developing frameworks for specific decision making. And in some cases, for some of these technologies, there is not even an institutional home. Take, for example, carbon dioxide removal. That has always been part of the agenda here in the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. One can talk about governance challenges because there is at least an institution. When it comes to solar radiation modification, then there is no obvious institutional home. So the first question of governance is where do you discuss it? And then once you find a place or you create a place, then you discuss the issues, and there are many of them.
So regarding carbon dioxide removal, which is in the IPCC report recommended as, or at least named as one of the things we might have to resort to if we want to keep temperatures at 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels and not higher. Can you tell me a little bit about how we go about it? You mentioned the word technologies, but there's a natural way to go about it, right?
Yeah, so first of all, let's be clear that the IPCC doesn't recommend anything. What they do is they look at the science and say, if you do this, then that's what happens. If you don't do this, this is what happens. And what they said in this report is that they can look at different pathways to stay below 1.5 degrees, using different for energy, for land use, for different policy options. But no pathway exists without the use of carbon dioxide removal. In other words, it doesn't matter what you do, doesn't matter what is the mixture of policies that you implement at the global level, some level of carbon dioxide reduction will be necessary. Moreover, and this is very significant also, the longer we wait for the substantial reduction of emissions that one has to do at the global level, the more carbon dioxide removal you will need. And so if you don't do it now, then you're going to end up with a much more substantial challenge later, recognizing that removing carbon dioxide is generally much more expensive than putting it in the first place. Now, there are many different methods of carbon dioxide removal. First of all, there are what some people refer to as nature-based solutions. They are basically growing trees, increasing the carbon content of soils. These are all things where basically you maintain the level of carbon in a natural way. But it's not completely natural either, because if you want to increase, because that's what we want to do, then you have to do more afforestation, reforestation. So it's more accurate to call it nature-based than natural. So there are those technologies. Then there are technologies that are technology-based, usually direct chemical capture of the carbon dioxide through various means, and then you can collect and liquefy or some other way, and then you can store that somewhere in a mine or under the sea or many different ways of doing it. But the point is to take the carbon out of the atmosphere and then isolate it for a long time. And then there are mixed methods which use partially chemical, partially nature-based solutions, such as one that is called bioenergy with carbon capture and storage, where you grow biomass like trees or sugarcane, convert it to electricity, immediately capture the carbon, and then isolate it and store it underground.
So either way, we're going to have to do this. And the extent to which we're going to have to do it will depend on the amount of emissions reductions that we manage to achieve. Is that correct?
That's correct. And having said that, what is really important is that we don't have all the governance mechanisms in place to do so. First of all, we don't know who is responsible for this. Who is responsible for take out the carbon? Because it's not just about balancing our current emissions. It's also taking out the carbon that is already there. So who is responsible? Who will pay for that? And then how do you measure it? How do you measure it in a comparative way so you can compare what Canada is doing with Costa Rica and with Sudan, different countries, different capacities? So that's the kind of governance challenge that our initiative is trying to promote in this process.
What are the risks of doing this? Are there any risks in using technology to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere?
There are plenty of risks, and there are direct environmental impacts, and there are indirect impacts. For example, if you have to convert a great deal of land to produce bioenergy, then it is possible, it is likely, in fact, that you will displace food production. And if you displace food production, then the global food prices will rise, hurting potentially the people who are poor and vulnerable to such price rises. So, but there are substantial direct environmental impacts. If you grow trees on large scale, you're going to have water use, pesticide use. You will have impacts on biodiversity because they tend to be monoculture plantations. So lots of impacts like that. There is no free lunch out there.
Here at the COP24, there are a lot of conversations about climate action financing. Is this particular aspect of climate action being discussed in terms of financing?
Not so much right now, because this is one of the governance issues that we're concerned with, that the concept of removals has not been much discussed. It's always been here, it's always been part of the agenda, but the focus has been on emission reductions, which it has to be. We must reduce the emissions whatever we do. But the time has come where what the IPCC has shown in simple language is that simply relying on emission reductions, we simply cannot stay below 1.5 degrees. It's gone beyond that. We have emitted too much carbon dioxide already. So now the time has come to start talking more seriously about carbon dioxide removal. There are some development banks, we know, we've discussed, for example, that in Asian Development Bank, they seem to be already funding some projects that are about carbon dioxide removal. So this is going to happen increasingly, that countries will start saying, well, let's see how we can finance in the developing countries, for example, certain carbon dioxide removal activities. So I suspect it will happen increasingly so, but it needs the kind of policy direction that this process can do, and it won't happen this time. Maybe it will happen in a few years from now.
You mentioned earlier that your initiative also works on a different kind of geoengineering, which is working on solar radiation. Do you mind telling us a bit about that?
Yeah, solar radiation modification is another family of technologies, commonly also referred to as geoengineering or solar geoengineering. There are different names to it, and it's in evolution, the name. So you will find many different names to it. But ultimately, these are technologies that affect the radiation balance of the Earth. And there are different ways of doing it. The one that is most common is called stratospheric aerosol injection. And the idea is to inject particles, different kinds of particles, into the stratosphere. And basically they will reflect more sunlight to go back into space and thereby cooling the planet. There's a natural analog to this. When there's a volcanic eruption, then you get a big bang and lots of materials go into the atmosphere. But among those materials, there are sulfur aerosols that are released from the volcano and they go into the lower stratosphere, where they act like this. And after a major volcanic eruption, you can actually measure how the global temperature goes down. There was a big explosion, a volcanic eruption in the Philippines in 1991. And after the eruption, you could measure that the global temperature went down by about a half a degree centigrade and stayed like that for almost a year and then went back up again. So the scientists are saying we can do this better, and that's how they propose the solar radiation modification. Now, the challenges of governance are much, much larger than for carbon dioxide removal. First of all, we don't know well enough the risks on the environment, on humanity, on people, on agriculture. So we don't know enough the details of the risks, and we don't know the potential benefit well enough to make sure that indeed it would work. Computer models, say the scientists, seem to indicate that it would work. Many scientists are convinced that this is a technology that is available to reduce the global temperature rise by 1.5 degrees, and therefore it could be potentially very helpful. The challenge is, first of all, that it does not solve the problem because it doesn't take the carbon away. So it's like if you have an infection, you feel bad, you take an aspirin, you feel better, but the infection is still there. And in the case of climate, if you use solar radiation modification to cool the planet, maybe the planet will be colder, but the carbon dioxide is still in the air, it still causes acidification of the oceans. And once you start, and if you're not reducing your emissions, you have to keep doing the solar radiation modification forever, or until the time comes when you stop the emissions come back to acceptable levels. And that is a very difficult situation, and it could commit the world to many, many decades, possibly generations of solar radiation modification, which would be an ethical question, something that our children and their children would have to live with. So solar radiation modification is not a solution. It could be that it may be necessary in addition to the massive emission reductions that we may have to do, and also to the carbon dioxide removal we may have to do. So it's supplementary. It's not instead of. It's not an alternative. The other issue and challenge with the solar radiation modification is that it is quite cheap. The direct costs are cheap. Studies seem to indicate that one could do that at a global level for a few billion dollars annually. Now, a few billion dollars, if you and I had it, it's a lot of money, right? But for the world as a whole to address this issue is quite cheap. In fact, there are many who are concerned that an individual country could just simply decide that they want to do it. Or even a rich individual, a billionaire, could say, I want to save the world and I'm just going to do this. How many billionaires do we know who could maintain many, many years long solar radiation modification from the wealth that they have currently? So the barrier to entry of actually using this technology is low, and therefore it's a risk. And this is another challenge of solar radiation modification governance, on how to make sure, how can you work with the governments to make sure that if ever somebody does it, there will be an appropriate reaction, for example, in the Security Council, because it has global security implications. Or alternatively, what should countries do collectively to reduce the probability of something like this happening? And then, apart from this sort of let's call it unilateral, ungoverned action. But even if you think in a rational world, the question arises, who should take a decision whether or not to make use of this technology?